William, thank you very much. Clement Freud, of blessed memory to liberals, used to say that I was the only person in the House of Commons who'd been trained to kill, because Mrs. Thatcher was self-taught. Some of you may remember the old song, Dem Bones, Dem Bones, Dem Dry Bones. So you're going to hear a bit about that. You're going to hear a little bit about what I'm calling slightly tongue-in-cheek Ashdown's third law. Please don't ask me what Ashdown's first and second laws are. And you're going to hear a bit of poetry, so let's start with the poetry. There is a wonderful poem. I wonder if you're a literary audience, you'll be able to identify who it was. Written, I guess, about the same time as this place was built. Written in the aftermath of a terrible defeat by a bunch of primitives of the greatest army in the world, our army, and written because the poet began to feel that things were changing. And the poem, the stanza of which goes, listen to the way it changes, goes like this. High upon the hill of summer, lazy with the flow of streams, hark, I hear a distant drummer drumming like a sound in dreams, far and near and low and louder. On the roads of earth go by, dear to friend and food to powder, soldiers marching soon to die. Come on, somebody here knows that. Somebody here knows it. Sorry? No, it isn't Kipling, actually. It's A. Houseman. It's a stanza from the Shropshire Lad. And what Houseman could sense, written actually in the dying days, years after the Boer War, we shall return to that, was that this long sylvan period of a stable peace and a stable order in the world was coming to a close. And there were dark days ahead. If you listen to Mahler's symphonies, you can hear the same message. I think we're living in just one of those times. I think it happens in history that a period of relative stability is about to give way to a period of turbulence. And it nearly always happens, by the way, when the gimbals of power shift. And in that sense, I think the next few decades are likely to be as turbulent, as dangerous, as tough, and as difficult as any, probably more so, than any we have seen, certainly within our lifetimes and arguably for the last 100 years. And there are three phenomena which seem to me to contribute to this. The first is that the gimbals of world power are shifting. Well, that occurs from time to time. It occurred in the 18th century. The last time world power shifted on this kind of scale, it shifted across the Atlantic, just about the time Houseman was writing, from this side of the Atlantic Ocean to the other. What I think you're now seeing is an even more substantial shift of world power. Put your hand over the side of the boat, you'll feel how strong the tide is running. From the west to the east, from the nations gathered around the Atlantic shoreboard to the nations on the Pacific Rim. Now, I'm not saying for one moment that that will be smooth or without its own turbulence. I personally believe that China's rise to superpower status will be interrupted by a period of very strong internal turbulence. And in China's case, you should never underestimate where that will lead to. But I have no doubt that this economic crisis, to give one example, is different from the previous ones we've experienced. We will not, this time, bounce comfortably back to where we were and then continue. I think we will see the relative position of the Western nations significantly diminished and the relative position in terms of economic power to start with, followed by state power, followed inevitably by, no doubt, military power, will be increased and ours will be diminished. Some of my left-wing friends tell me that they think that we have seen the zenith of American power. America is now in the great, as Kipling and the Recessionist, his poem, the Recession said, I don't remember the line now, but anyway, the point of zenith had passed and America was beginning to decline. I don't think that's true, by the way. I think you know a powerful nation, a nation that still has a claim to power, to being a powerful nation on earth by its capacity to change. It's the sclerotic, it's those resistant to change, which is the harbinger of the end of greatness. And of course, we've seen that in Europe. And America is still capable of extraordinary change. The election of Barack Obama is an example of that. If you want another, look at the speed with which the American army completely changed its policy and attitude on counterinsurgency under Petraeus. It would have taken the British Army years to make that change. The Americans made it in a couple of years. So I don't doubt for a second that America remains the most powerful nation on earth for the next decade, potentially longer. But the world would have changed. The world, the context in which the United States exercised that power is going to change. We are no longer going to be, we are no longer today, living in a world dominated by a single superpower, a monopolar world. We are beginning now to see the growth of other power centers in the world, and we're going to see a multipolar world beginning to emerge. If you want a comparison, go back to the 19th century, take a look at Europe, read George Canning, the great British Foreign Secretary, who used to talk about the European Areopagiticus, the five-sided balance of power in Europe, the concert of Europe, in which Britain's role was always to play to the balance. If Paris got together with Berlin, we got together with Austro-Hungary to make the balance, and kept the peace of Europe, kept us out of European engagements. I think what we're going to see is a multipolar world in which foreign policy will have to be much more subtle, much more light-footed, and that our interests as Europe will not always be tied to the apron strings of our neighbourhood superpower. We haven't needed a foreign policy in the past. That was good enough, for most of us, at least. I think that's going to change. By the way, I think it'll change for America, too. My guess is that America are going to find that they have other interests in the world, not just the Europeans. We have been used to a period in which the European interest for America was at the top of the pantheon of their concerns. That's no longer going to be the case. Look at what Obama's been doing in the first months, and you'll see that he is looking across the Pacific quite as much as he's looking across the Atlantic. Saying the Atlantic won't be important, but America too will be responding to this new shape in world power. My guess, for what it's worth, is that Europe will be less important for any future United States president, including Barack Hussein Obama, than it has for every past one, including George W. Bush. And that has profound implications for us in Europe. Profound implications. If we are seeing an America with different priorities, an America that no longer provides the ready security guarantee behind which many European countries have sheltered, so as to take a free ride on security without being serious about defence. By the way, there's hardly an American soldier left in Europe today. That security guarantee doesn't exist. The only American soldiers left in Europe, by and large, are those who are servicing the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So America, with other priorities, an assertive Russia rising to our east. My worry about Russia in the long term isn't its strength, but when it discovers how weak it is, that's when I think the really dangerous moment arrives. But nevertheless, we're dealing with an assertive Russia today, prepared to use levers like energy. We're seeing a rising East, a rising China, a rising India. You know, if we in Europe don't realize that the right response to these completely changed European situation in which we find ourselves is to deepen the integration of our foreign policy and defence, we are bloody fools. We are bloody fools. And the next 10 years are going to be much, much, much more dangerous for us. I think Europe as refuge becomes a much more sellable proposition for those who are arguing the case for European integration, which, by the way, those who have argued it, including me, have intellectually and comprehensively lost. Take a look and see what's happening in Iceland and in Norway, and indeed in Holland, where opinion in favour of Europe is now shifting. So that's the kind of world in which I think we're going to be living, a world in which our foreign policy is going to have to be much more subtle. And there are going to be occasions in which we have other interests rather than those which are simply those of the United States. The second factor, is this fact, that power has now moved, and it is one of the big events of our time, though little enough commented on. We created the nation state as the structure and context in which power could be contained, in which power could be brought to regulation and law. Power has now moved substantially outside the context of the nation state and migrated onto the global stage, where by and large it is not subject to regulation, or if it is, it's too weak, where by and large it is not subject to the rule of law until we create the institutions to do it. And of course this has been beneficial to us for a bit. Lawless spaces, and the global space is a lawless space nowadays, quite as much as Afghanistan or Iraq, are quite useful to the powerful. They can make use of it for a bit, the transnational corporations, the satellite broadcasters, Yahoo and Google. It's always been jolly useful to us. But you see, what always happens is lawless spaces get occupied and populated by the destroyers. And that's what happened in 9/11. We suddenly discovered that it wasn't just us using the lawless spaces, so was international terrorism. So is international crime. It's not an accident that Al-Qaeda lives there. It finds it just as convenient as Afghanistan. And it uses those global spaces where power is to prosecute its ideas, to carry out its attacks using the systems of international mass transport, to move around its money. It's calculated that 60% of the money, the $4 million taken to fund 9/11, actually passed through the hands of those who were living in the Twin Towers that 9/11 destroyed. So if the phenomenon of our time, one of the phenomena, is the globalization of power, then one of the challenges of our time is to bring governments to the global space. You know, there is a rule of thumb, dear to liberals. Of course, that was what the 1832 Reform Act was about. Where power goes, governance must follow. And our capacity to be able to bring governance to the global space will in large measure, I think, determine whether or not these decades are more or less turbulent. And two thoughts for you. The first is, my guess is, I don't like the conclusion, but my guess is that this is likely more to be done by the creation of treaty-based institutions than a spawning and proliferation of United Nations institutions. My guess is that the WTO, of course we all understand the failure of the Darfur Round and so on, but the WTO, treaty-based organization, managed this very neuralgic area of world trade highly successfully for a long time. Kyoto is another example. Maybe the G20 is reaching towards those kind of treaty-based organizations that will bring governance to the world space. We'll continue to need the UN, of course, as a legitimizer of action, subcontractor perhaps to coalitions of the willing, of the actions where they're tough, and above all, there's the framework for the development of containment of international law, as we see that having to develop as one of the institutions for global governance. So that's where we have to be going. Are we going there? Not much, it seems to me. Is there a recognition that we have to bring governance to the global space? Well, dimly, stimulated by the present economic crisis, seems to me is a very good example of what happens if you have power in the global space without regulation and without the rule of law. And now we come to the bit that I really want to talk about, the one I'm even more enthusiastic about. And here I come on to first Dem Bones, and Ashdown's famous third law. The third phenomenon of our time is this, that in a way that has never, ever happened before, we are now living in a completely interconnected world. And, of course, we always had. Diplomacy has been about the interconnections and about managing those interconnections. But this is now quantitatively different from what we have seen before. Everything is connected to everything. If we didn't know that before the global crisis, we certainly ought to know it now. We know perfectly well we can't deal with this within our own nations. We have to deal with it on the global stage because everything is connected to everything. Lehman Brothers is connected to everything. And we saw that. Imagine for a moment, this doesn't just happen internationally, of course it happens locally as well. Imagine for a moment I was a Minister of Defence and it's 15 years ago and I'm talking about British security. What would I have talked about? I'd have talked about the size of our army, the size of our air force, the size of our navy. That would have been it. That was what British defence was about when I was a British soldier. Now it's about everything. Now you have to talk to the Minister of Health because pandemic disease is a threat to our national security. You have to talk to the Minister of Agriculture because food security is part of our security. You have to talk to the Minister of Industry because the resilience of our systems is part of our security and a very potent form, place for those who would bring it down to attack. You have to talk to the Home Office suddenly. Suddenly! Security, the first thing a government has to offer, it's not about armed forces at all. It's about everything. Because everything is connected to everything. And what really matters is not the size of your army, your air force, or your navy, but your extent to which you can bring all of these together to focus on a single point. And it's our failure to do that. That, I think, will be one of the big conclusions of the IPPR report. It's our failure to do that that create this massive mismatch between actually what we think security is about and what it's actually about. Here's another example. Imagine standing before you now, you had not me, but Lord Roberts of Kandahar. Who was he? Come on, somebody knows. Correct. I'll come back to that too. Lord Roberts of Kandahar. He went to avenge my great-grandmother. My great-grandmother left Peshawar in the autumn of 1872 to go and join her husband in Kabul. Only escaped because she managed to get out before the massacre in the snows happening. And by the way, Roberts of Kandahar was sent in on a punitive war, just like this one, It took them, by the way, 30 years, the British, to set up the Second Afghan War, and most of that time was spent getting the relationships between the tribes in southern Afghanistan right before they sent him in. We never learned these lessons, do we? And he, of course, went in and succeeded. He won that Afghan War. And if he was here telling you how did he win it, what would he have talked about? He'd have talked about the sepoys, the Indian soldiers, whether the boots were good enough, the uniforms, the screw guns, the great screw guns they used to take up, and they were the equivalent of our B-52 bombers. We could strip them down, take them on a mountain, and destroy an Afghan village in a trice. Talked about those a bit. He may have talked a bit about the tribal relationships in places which you now know, like Helmand and Kandahar. But what wouldn't he have talked about? Wouldn't have talked about poppy fields. They were there. Lots of them. Didn't matter. In the slightest. Now they are connected right into our inner cities and to our battle against crime. He wouldn't have talked about jihadis in a cave, a mad jihadi in a cave. He was there too. Lots of them, by the way. Completely irrelevant to him. But now they're connected to that terrorist house in Bolton. He wouldn't have talked about collateral damage. He knocked down lots of Afghan villages, but it didn't matter because you didn't get to hear about it 6 weeks later anyway. It didn't matter in those days. Nowadays it is directly connected, collateral damage, to your capacity to win the essential battle, the battle for public support in the country in which you're intervening and in the broader international stage. Everything is connected to everything. And it's our complete failure to understand that that actually means we can't win in Afghanistan at present, because we haven't got our act together. Because things are not connected, because there isn't an international plan, because there's no coordination, because there's no unity. I mean, seriously, the big scandal of Afghanistan and our troops is not the fact we can't give them boots or helicopters. The big scandal is that young men and some young women are dying because our politicians can't get their acts together. That's the thing we should be shouting about. And it's an absolute disaster. So here is Ashdown's third law. If everything is connected to everything, and it's your capacity to bring things together, multiple disciplines and multiple contributors, to solving what is essentially a multi-layered problem, then the most important thing about what you can do is what you can do with others. You think your army unit is good if it has a certain capacity. No, it's not. Unless it can connect up with Bifid, who will come in straight after you've taken Musakala, which they don't at present, start rebuilding, and it's your connections with the other things that matter. The most important part of what you can do is what you can do with others. It isn't your capacity as a foreign office or a minister of agriculture or a Great Britain or a British army that matters. It's your capacity to dock with others that matters. If everything is connected to everything, then the thing that really matters is the interconnectors. And here we come to a problem. Here we come to a problem. Because our governments and our international structure is built in vertical structures, not network structures. Now, actually, just shortly after A. Housman wrote that poem, the great Haldane, first of the great Haldane committees sat, 1805, I think the date was, 1905, I think the date was. And it sat precisely because of the defeat we suffered at the hand of the Boers, the primitive enemy in a faraway place who weren't supposed to beat us. And it reconstructed government. And it reconstructed government according to the constructs and according to the model that was successful in the Industrial Revolution. It reconstructed governments on a vertical hierarchy with a specialization of tasks leading to a command center at the top. And what it did was replicate the commercial structures of the time. But if you look at modern business today, actually they stripped those hierarchies down. They've now flattened them. They're now networked organisation serving an end. And a government can't do networking. In fact, what you hear, the screaming you hear of the gears from Whitehall is essentially stovepiped organisations run by vertical mentalities of the people at the top trying desperately to network. And they can't. They can't network in Afghanistan. They can't network here in Britain. They can't bring themselves together. Now, another Haldane committee, Ashdown committee, that'd be a good idea. To write a reconstruct government on a network basis is an answer, but actually I don't think it is. I think it's what's in the brain. Take a look at our Foreign Office. Our Foreign Office still persists that it's a dizzy organisation populated by extremely sophisticated, clever people who write elegant telegrams from abroad. Actually, that's not the Foreign Office's job. What the Foreign Office should be doing is acting as a project manager, A manager who brings together, can bring together those other contributors to tackle an issue like Bosnia, like Afghanistan, like global warming or whatever. You see, it's the most important bit about what you can do is what you can do with others. It's the interconnectors that matter most, and we don't have them. We don't have them in Afghanistan, and young soldiers are losing their life as a result of it. We don't have them in our domestic policies, and we don't have them internationally either. I mean, let me just put it to you this way. The last great attempt at unilateralism was conducted by the most powerful nation on earth, and still it failed. George W. Bush's effort at unilateralism failed. Only multilateralism will work today, and it's time we started to construct the networks that make that a possibility, both externally and internally. I'm going to end now, but I'm not going to end before entertaining just one other thought and a little bit of poetry. If I'm right, if the really interesting third phenomenon of our time is that everything is connected to everything, and it's what you can do with others that matters, then something very extraordinary has also happened that we need to think about. And it's this. Since time immemorial, men, and they usually have been men, by the way, have assured the security of those under with them or in their tribe by the system of collective security. If you wanted to be safe in the Stone Age, you were part of a larger family or a larger tribe that could collectively beat off your enemies. In the days of the nation state, the powerful nation state was able to do that. And when nation states themselves weren't enough, we went to NATO, collective security organization. But suddenly, if we are now subject corporately to the same threat, the threat of weapons of mass destruction, which now can kill everything, the threat of global warming, environmental pollution, and if we are all connected, if everyone's connected to everyone, then collective security isn't enough. You have to start thinking about common security. You have to start recognizing that one of the revelations of 9/11 is that we share a destiny with our enemies. We share a destiny with other parts of the world that are not connected to us. And it's the understanding of the concepts of common security, incidentally, which enabled me, along with others, I was a very junior member at the time, to participate and make a success of the disarmament talks in Geneva, because we realized we shared a destiny in a nuclear age with those with whom we were negotiating. And it was a win-win situation if we both stepped back from it. The environmental threat to the world makes us all share in everybody else's destiny. Common security becomes an issue. In Ireland, the revelation about the common security shared between Protestants and Catholics has enabled the peace there to continue. Enables me to sit down, by the way, with the guy who was put me on the death list when I was a British soldier there, around a table in Belfast to see if I can reach an agreement on the issue of parades, because people understand that they share a common security. It is the absence of an understanding of common security that denies Israel the capacity to build peace, because they too share a common destiny with their so-called enemies and the Palestinians. It's the absence, I have some friends from Bosnia here, of this concept of common security that enables the Bosniaks, the Croats, and especially perhaps the Serbs in Republika Srpska to continue to pursue their old war aims through the peace structures of Dayton. I'm not saying that common security will be the only security we have. We'll have to have collective security instruments too. But sometime an understanding of the importance of common security is absolutely necessary. That great statement of John Donne's, "Send not to ask for whom the bell tolls. You know, every man's death affecteth me, for I'm involved in mankind. Send not to ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee." For him, a moral proposition. For us, actually, the beginnings of something new, it seems to me, in diplomacy and international defence. Or take us straight back to that famous 1879 moment, because when Lord Roberts of Kandahar was knocking down Afghan villages to avenge my grandmother, my predecessor as leader of the country's Liberal Party was standing up in the Second Midlothian campaign to be Prime Minister of Britain, leader of the opposition, older, by the way, than John McCain, speaking to a country which was gripped in the Second Afghan War, and he had the courage to say these immortal words: "Do not forget that the sanctity of life in the hill villages of Afghanistan amongst the winter snows is no less inviolate in the eye of Almighty God as can be your own. Do not forget that he who made you brothers in the same flesh and blood bound you by the laws of mutual love, and that love is not limited to the shores of this island, but it passeth across the whole surface of the earth, encompassing the greatest along with the meanest in its unmeasured scope." For him, a statement of morality. for us, I think, quite close to an equation for survival. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Paddy. That makes a huge number of